Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tortoise. Hello, it's Claudia here, host of the Slow Newscast, and you're listening to State of Netanyahu, a three-part series from Tortoise. In this episode, reporter Donald McIntyre investigates a pivotal period in Benjamin Netanyahu's leadership, from 2009 to 2020. This is episode 2, The Magician.
I've come here to Cairo to seek a new beginning between the United States and Muslims around the world.
Barack Obama's standing at a podium in Cairo. It's June 2009, less than 5 months into his presidency, and he's addressing Egyptian university students, but actually he's really addressing the entire Muslim world.
Principles of justice and progress, tolerance and the dignity of all human beings.
I'm Donald McIntyre, and I've been covering the Middle East for a couple of decades. On that day, I was sitting in a cafe in Gaza City watching this on TV. The Palestinian cafe owner wasn't much interested in what the US president might have to say, and he'd been a bit grumpy even about finding the right channel. But then...
So let there be no doubt. The situation for the Palestinian people is intolerable. And America will not turn our backs on the legitimate Palestinian aspiration for dignity, opportunity, and a state of their own.
The cafe owner looked up from the cups he was washing, suddenly gripped by what Obama was saying. The new president stressed America's special bond with Israel and the importance of it gaining recognition from its neighbors. But he also said,
"The United States does not accept the legitimacy of continued Israeli settlements." This construction violates previous agreements and undermines efforts to achieve peace. It is time for these settlements to stop.
I wondered how this was playing out at Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office in Jerusalem. Netanyahu is easily Israel's longest-serving prime minister. He's taken the country from the promise of peace in the early 90s to where it is today. In the previous episode, I tracked his first term when he was trying to keep the idea of a Palestinian state at bay. But I still want to understand how Israel's complex and dependent relationship with America works, and what happens when two strong leaders with different characters and views of the world come up against each other. It's 2009, and for such an ambitious politician, a decade since he was last prime minister must have felt like an eternity, especially when his party had been all but written off. It's taken a while, but he's turned things round, and just a few short months before Obama's speech in Cairo, he's back in power. And right away, he knows he's in trouble.
He was scared of Obama.
Anshul Pfeffer's written a biography of Benjamin Netanyahu.
Obama had given this very confident speech. So Netanyahu certainly had reason to fear a massive pressure campaign.
He called me and he said, I want to talk to you about Obama. I knew Obama. I dealt with Obama. I worked with Obama for a few months, so I had some contact with him. And he said, what do you think I should do?
Ehud Olmert's a former Israeli prime minister.
I say to him, look, Barack Obama is an historical figure. He's a graduate summa cum laude of Harvard University. He was the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Law Review. I mean, you talk about a very outstanding person. Be humble. I say to him, be humble.
Obama's Cairo speech is made on a trip which includes Saudi Arabia, but not Israel. In fact, the president doesn't visit Netanyahu at all in his first term.
And that was seen as a snub to Israel.
Aleph Ben is the editor-in-chief of Haaretz, Israel's oldest newspaper. He says the prime minister felt under enormous pressure to fall in line with Obama's policy.
10 days later, Netanyahu had to find a response.
On a Sunday evening in June 2009, Netanyahu stands on the stage of an Israeli university, Bar Ilan, near Tel Aviv, and he says something quite extraordinary.
I share the president's desire to bring about a new era of reconciliation in our region.
It certainly seems like he's tailoring the speech for Obama's ears.
And if the Palestinians recognize Israel as the state of the Jewish people, then we will be ready in a future peace agreement to reach a solution where a demilitarized Palestinian state exists alongside the Jewish state.
On the surface, this seems like a huge reversal of a lifelong, deeply held antipathy to the idea of a Palestinian state. And it was what President Obama had been hoping to hear.
At that time, it was seen as something genuine that the Americans could work with.
Aleph Ben again.
And he agreed to a settlement freeze of 10 months, which was also unprecedented by any government.
But lots of people saw the Bar-Ilan University speech as little more than a political ploy, a means of keeping Obama at bay by playing for time. Netanyahu, at his wiliest, conscious that his domestic audience wanted to hear something else.
So if you actually read the Bar-Ilan speech, you see there's a very long list of caveats there on what exactly the Palestinian state would look like.
They would have to agree to a completely demilitarized state with no control over its borders or airspace. They'd have to give up Jerusalem as their capital and give up the right to return for Palestinian refugees around the world. Biographer Anshul Pfeffer again.
Obviously, no Palestinian leader could accept that.
Former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert sees the speech as a cynical, calculated ploy, ensuring Netanyahu would never have to enter any real negotiations.
This was a pre-planned, calculated strategy in order to separate himself for any pressure, possible pressure to deal with them, because dealing with them means only one thing: withdrawals, concessions, territories, whatever. So the only possible way not to be put in a situation where he have to argue about what should we give them, what should we not give them, where should we withdraw from or whatever, was to say from the outset, they are not qualified. They are haters of Jews, they are anti-Semites and so on, and they are, you know, murderers, whatever.
And Netanyahu's actually admitted to playing exactly this kind of game with the Americans before. Back in 2001, when he was out of office, he was secretly filmed talking to residents of a West Bank settlement. This is him at his most unguarded. Sitting on a sofa in a living room, he explains to the family he's visiting that what Israel needs to do is hit the Palestinians so hard that they find it unbearable. That's never been done properly before, he says. The woman of the family wonders if he isn't worried about what the world would say if Israel did that. No, he says. Especially the US. If they say something, so what? They can easily be maneuvered, he tells her. It's like with the Oslo Accords, he goes on. I gave them my own interpretation of the agreements. Then he goes into detail about how he obfuscated and played games with parameters and definitions. And that's how I broke the Oslo Accords, he boasts, before sitting back on the sofa, smiling proudly. The thing is, if he'd wanted to, Netanyahu probably could have advanced a peace process in his second term. In some ways, he might even have been in a stronger position to do so than his opponents on the left.
The right wing can often do things that the left wing can't.
Ahmed Haladi's a former Palestinian negotiator.
Because the right wing takes the left with it when it offers such concessions, whereas when the left tries to make the concessions, the right wing opposes it.
Because at this point, in 2010, Netanyahu's a hugely dominant figure in Israeli politics.
He was the only political leader in Israel who had the credibility to move ahead if he had wanted to forge a deal with the Palestinians.
Dalia Scheindlin's one of Israel's leading pollsters and a prominent commentator. According to her data, this may have been a moment when everything aligned.
I mean, we were all talking about the speech that he gave at Bar-Ilan in 2009, where he, you know, acknowledged the possibility of a Palestinian state, which would imply negotiation to get there and a comprehensive political agreement. And it was a phase, certainly in 2010, when we still had a very firm majority of the Israeli public, including among the Jewish public, who supported the general concept of a two-state solution. There was about 70% of all Israelis. It never happened, but I remember doing survey research and thinking, he is the person who could do it because he has enough support in Israeli society as a leader. And, you know, if you see the graph, it's stunning.
It's not long before all the hype around Netanyahu's speech starts giving way to reality. The settlement freeze, for a start.
I think it was a 10-month moratorium on some settlement construction. Not all settlements, so there were a number of exclusions and loopholes.
Khaled El-Gindi used to be an advisor to the Palestinian leadership and took part in negotiations with Israel. He's now a senior fellow on Palestinian affairs at the Middle East Institute.
East Jerusalem settlements were excluded. It was only in relation to publicly sponsored settlement construction as opposed to from the private sector. And it was only about new construction starts. So existing construction projects in the settlements could continue. And so it was kind of loaded with loopholes, but in any case, it was kind of enough to give Abbas.
That's Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president.
To give Abbas the cover to participate in negotiations directly. And eventually they did that. Very, very briefly, I think it was the September of 2010, they launched these direct negotiations. And then once the moratorium expired and it was clear Netanyahu was not going to renew it, then the whole process fell apart.
That spring in 2011 was not just any spring.
The North African nation of Tunisia is under a state of emergency. That's because rioters have been taking to the streets.
President Obama's excited by the groundswell of uprisings around the Arab world. He sees it as a real opportunity for change and democracy. And that's what it feels like to those of us reporting on the protests from the center of Cairo's Tahrir Square. There's a real sense of history turning. But it looks very different from where Benjamin Netanyahu's sitting. All the regional instabilities are unnerving. Israel made peace with Egypt ages ago, and it counts President Hosni Mubarak as an ally. Netanyahu fears the alternative is not democracy, but radical extremism, that the Arab Spring will be followed by an Islamic winter. But the American president's determined to show he's with the protesters on the streets.
We have the chance to show that America values the dignity of the street vendor in Tunisia more than the raw power of the dictator.
Standing at a lectern in the White House, Obama delivers a speech lasting three quarters of an hour. Back in Jerusalem, there's just one bit of it that stands out.
The United States believes that the borders of Israel and Palestine should be based on the 1967 lines with mutually agreed swaps, so that secure and recognized borders are established for both states. The Palestinian people must have the right to govern themselves.
The Israeli Prime Minister is caught off guard. The 1967 borders refers to land Israel occupied after the Six-Day War, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. It isn't such an outlandish position. Most negotiations had this at least as a starting point. But Netanyahu's furious. He's been squeezed by Obama again, and he hasn't even been briefed. And it just so happens that he's due for a formal visit to Washington the very next day after the speech. So he boards the plane, but the whole way over the Atlantic, he's fuming.
Let me first of all welcome once again Prime Minister Netanyahu, who I think has now been here seven times.
At first, that next morning in the White House feels like business as usual. Obama and Netanyahu sit close together on chairs, slightly tilted towards each other. The press are gathered and cameras flash as the two exchange pleasantries. But then Netanyahu's tone suddenly changes, and all the pent-up rage bubbles over.
I think for there to be peace, the Palestinians will have to accept some basic reality. The first is that while Israel is prepared to make generous compromises for peace, it cannot go back to the 1967 lines, because these lines are indefensible.
The tone is so obviously inappropriate. You just don't talk publicly like that to an American president, particularly not when you're a guest in his house. But now the wheels are off, and Netanyahu can't stop.
So it's not going to happen. Everybody knows it's not going to happen. And I think it's time to tell the Palestinians forthrightly, it's not going to happen.
And then, right there, in front of the world's press, he starts lecturing the President of the United States on Jewish history.
Of Israel. And you know, we've been around for almost 4,000 years. We've experienced struggle and suffering like no other people. We've gone through expulsions and pogroms and massacres and the murder of millions. But I can say that...
Obama's looking intently at him, but it's impossible to read his face. He's leaning on his arm with his hand covering his mouth. Ever since President Harry Truman became the first Western leader to recognize Israel in 1948, the country has grown to expect a unique degree of American moral, political, and financial support. Israel depends on it, but it hasn't always shown a great deal of gratitude. Even by those standards, Benjamin Netanyahu takes it to a new level. He does the very opposite of what former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert had advised him to do.
He was arrogant. I'm Bibi Netanyahu. I'm the smartest guy on earth. You know, who are you? From day one, he has antagonized and insulted and looked down at Obama.
I certainly remember the disrespect.
Gerald Feierstein's a career diplomat who was number two in the U.S. State Department's Near East section during Obama's presidency.
I mean, look, the reality is nobody likes Bibi Netanyahu. Nobody, you know, thinks that he's a good guy. He's not. You know, so him coming into the White House and talking to Obama like that, I think, you know, probably just reinforced all of the negative ideas that people in Washington have about Netanyahu.
The Israeli Prime Minister's relationship with Obama never really recovers from this episode.
Netanyahu paints the standard smile on his face and engages in diplomatic niceties, but
he really was absolutely unrelenting in his rage. And Netanyahu traduced Obama day after day after day. He was constantly calling him, you know, anti-Israel, or implying or having his other cronies call him anti-Semitic, and, you know, railing against everything Obama stood for. It didn't matter how much Obama was, you know, bestowing any sort of bear hug. Netanyahu was just portraying him constantly as the enemy. And so it was a very, very divisive time.
On that same 2011 trip, Benjamin Netanyahu arranges with senior Republicans, Obama's opponents, to address both houses of Congress.
Israel will not return to the indefensible boundaries of 1967.
He doesn't totally dismiss the idea of a two-state solution, but
Israel will be generous on the size of a Palestinian state, but will be very firm on where we put the border with it. This is an important principle. Shouldn't be lost.
And he came to Congress, where he got 39, he got more standing ovations than Churchill did.
Former Palestinian negotiator Ahmed Haladi.
23, I think, standing ovations out of an endless, a rapturous reception behind the back of the administration.
Netanyahu also was very good at whipping up, at kind of playing Congress off of the White House, specifically the Obama White House.
Former advisor to the Palestinian leadership, Khaled El-Gindi.
We saw that again when Netanyahu came to Washington and kind of went above the head of the American president and addressed Congress, sort of stuck his finger directly in the eye of the president. And so Obama was kind of cornered.
The U.S. president had set his sights on getting some kind of deal between the Palestinians and the Israelis in his first term in office. His envoy, George Mitchell, has flown to the Middle East 19 times over 2 years, but Netanyahu is intractable. Mitchell eventually quits, and with relations between Obama and Netanyahu at an all-time low, the peace process stalls.
It led nowhere, but there was no real pressure from the Israeli public to do anything. There was no hurry.
Editor-in-chief of Haaretz, Alof Ben.
Now, for Netanyahu, a peace process, a serious one, leading to a Palestinian state or to something similar to it or to any territorial, giving away any territory to any Palestinian, mounted a domestic rift and civil war within Israel, which happened during Oslo with the Rabin assassination and happened not with violence, but with very strong protest against the Gaza disengagement. He didn't want it.
No hurry, dragging his feet and playing for time. You can see the beginnings here of what would become his long-term strategy, parking the irksome issue of negotiations altogether, managing rather than resolving the conflict with the Palestinians, and treating the issue of Iran as vastly more important.
Now time is running out. The hinge of history may soon turn, for the greatest danger of all could soon be upon us.
It was something Netanyahu raised in that 2011 speech to Congress, the idea that if Iran was allowed to develop a nuclear weapon, it would then be immune to any kind of control.
A nuclear-armed Iran would ignite a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. It would give terrorists a nuclear umbrella. It would make the nightmare of nuclear terrorism a clear and present danger throughout the world. I want you to understand what this means, because if we don't stop it, it's coming.
His tone is urgent, though not as urgent as it will become. Iran has to be stopped before it's too late. Netanyahu's arguing that the opportunity to hit its nuclear facilities is slipping away because the sites could become so well protected it wouldn't be possible to bomb them. The Israeli PM was suggesting he was readying the military for a strike, I remember the fevered speculation in parts of the press about the prospect and whether that might spark a much wider regional conflagration. Israeli analysts I spoke to at the time were divided about whether it might happen, but past and former heads of Israel's security agencies were against it. So why was Netanyahu banging the drum so loudly?
You've never had protests for or against doing X or Y on Iran in Israel. It's never formed or brought down or threatened a coalition government.
Daniel Levy was a negotiator for the Israeli government back at the turn of the century. He says not only did Iran play well with the voters, it was also a clever diplomatic tool. Netanyahu could use it to avoid talking about the stalled peace process and his continued expansion of the settlements in the West Bank and Jerusalem.
And Netanyahu understood that this was his way of being able to shift the conversation in the international terrain. Any engagement with a Western ally would begin with, why are you not doing more on Iran? Immediately deflecting the conversation, the criticism, the who's playing offense and who's playing defense in this meeting, from the ground on which Netanyahu might feel uncomfortable to the ground on which he could go on the offensive.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
That's a sort of freedom, like an intrinsic knowledge, like you are part ocean, ocean is part you. You have salt water in your body. You are part of this.
Oceans, life underwater. A new podcast all about the oceans and the mind-blowing life within them.
Subscribe now to Oceans, Life Underwater on your favorite podcast app.
Okay, so I need to pause here to give you the lay of the land, so to speak. At this point, the Palestinians are divided. They're divided physically between these two bits of land, the West Bank, which is being slowly eroded by new and expanding Israeli settlements that the rest of the world considers illegal, and Gaza, which is under a draconian blockade. It's a 45 square kilometre patch of land surrounded by tall barriers and Israeli security controlling everything and everyone that wants to go in and out. The Palestinians are also divided politically. Fatah, a nationalist party headed by President Mahmoud Abbas, rules over the Palestinians in the West Bank, and Hamas, an Islamist nationalist party, rules over Gaza. Fatah and Hamas are not friends. They've clashed in Gaza where there was a civil war in 2007. All this suits the Israeli Prime Minister. Later, Netanyahu will be more open about this policy to divide and rule. Anyone who wants to thwart the establishment of a Palestinian state has to support bolstering Hamas, he'll tell his party in March 2019. This is part of our strategy to isolate the Palestinians in Gaza from the Palestinians in the West Bank. It's a strategy that'll come back to haunt him.
It's important also to acknowledge that divide and rule when you're acting in a kind of colonial policy space is hardly an Israeli Zionist invention. But it is an important part of how you manage that population that you are in control of, whose rights you are ensuring cannot be fulfilled.
Daniel Levy says while Hamas and Fatah were at odds, the Israeli leader could argue there was no partner for peace.
And so sometimes the actions on the Israeli side are to make sure that the Palestinian division is nurtured, encouraged, and kept in place. And there are iterations of that in Netanyahu's policies at various occasions, of which 2014 might be one.
There's this moment in 2014 when both Fatah and Hamas decide going it alone isn't that great. Hamas is fed up with the blockade, which is really starting to pinch in Gaza, and President Abbas knows he can't get the peace process restarted with Fatah alone. So both parties put aside their grievances and decide to move towards a new joint government. But before they can get things started, Netanyahu orders a major military onslaught on Gaza. The reason for the war, ostensibly at least, is the murder of three Israeli teenagers in the West Bank. They're kidnapped and shot by Palestinian militants one night while hitchhiking home. In retaliation, a group of Israelis kidnap a 16-year-old Palestinian boy from a street in Jerusalem and burn him to death just outside the city. More clashes erupt, and Hamas starts firing rockets into Israel. The war goes on for weeks.
Overnight, Israeli forces fired flares into the skies above Gaza as they pummeled the strip with artillery.
I was there, covering the conflict from inside Gaza. I visited UN shelters where Palestinians taking refuge were killed by artillery strikes. I saw homes where extended families lived wiped out because the IDF suspected there might be a single Hamas operative inside. Back then, the ferocity of the onslaught was unprecedented. 2,220 Palestinians were killed, according to UN figures, along with 67 Israeli soldiers. The war ends with a sort of draw. Both sides claim victory, but in fact Hamas is left in power and the siege remains in place. Israel has long given up trying to remove Hamas. Instead, it relies on a tactic that comes to be known as mowing the grass. As soon as it feels Hamas has built up its military capabilities, Israeli forces launch military operations in Gaza, taking out some of their sites, but leaving them in control. For most of his 6 years in office so far, Benjamin Netanyahu's line has been that he's prepared to consider peace negotiations if he has the right partner, and if the Palestinian leadership is prepared to sign up to his stringent, and the Palestinians would say impossible, conditions. But in 2015, the election feels too close to call, and Netanyahu knows from past experience, if he wants to win, he needs to play to his far-right base. And so 2 weeks before the vote, he hardens his position. He now categorically says there will not be a Palestinian state. And the day of the vote, he warns his constituency they have to get to the polling stations to stop Arab voters pushing him out of power. Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship make up 20% of the electorate, but there was no evidence of a conspiracy to unseat him. His tactics nevertheless work.
His surprising and crushing victory, the product of an 11th-hour push for right-wing votes, promising there would be no Palestinian state on his watch, and whipping up fear on Facebook with a warning to the base, get out and vote, to prevent Arab parties from unseating him.
The right regime is in danger. The Arab voters are coming in huge amounts to the polls.
Netanyahu's inching the country further and further to the right, not just politically, but in lots of ways.
In 2015, he put together a right-wing coalition.
Haaretz editor-in-chief Alof Ben.
And its main focus was domestic. Once again, the ideas of changing Israeli society, giving more prominence to his own support base, reducing the influence of the left and the liberal camp in all kinds of public systems, you know, the judiciary, the military, education, academia, culture, etc., etc. So he was leading a culture war, and the more important thing, which was the pinnacle of the of that government, was the nation-state law, basic law, which says that Israel is a nation-state of the Jewish people and only the Jewish people, implying that non-Jewish peoples have secondary status at best, and also pledging that the state should develop Jewish settlements around the country.
It's his third consecutive term in office, and the longer a leader stays in power, the more they gain confidence in their rectitude. So it is with Netanyahu. Just a couple of months after his victory, he stands on stage and addresses the World Zionist Congress in Jerusalem, where he says this really quite remarkable thing. He gives them a little history lesson in which he essentially blames the Palestinians for the Holocaust.
Instigated by a call of the Mufti of Jerusalem, Haji Amin al-Husseini, who was later sought for war crimes in the Nuremberg trials because he had a central role in fomenting the final solution. He flew to Berlin. Hitler didn't want to exterminate the Jews at the time. He wanted to expel the Jews. And Haji Amin al-Husseini went to Hitler and said, if you expel them, they'll all come here. So what should I do with them? He asked. He said, burn them.
As soon as the comments hit the press, there's a huge online storm. Lots of people make fun of what seems like a ridiculous assertion. There's a spate of Mufti memes. The Mufti ate my homework. The Mufti was responsible for the dinosaurs going extinct. Things like that. But there are more serious comments too, like one from a German government spokesperson who says, there is no need to look elsewhere because Germany was entirely responsible for the Holocaust. By this point, it's clear that Netanyahu really doesn't believe in dialogue with the Palestinians, and he also doesn't want the US to engage in dialogue with Iran. And that's precisely what Obama plans to do. In his second term, President Obama all but gives up on peace between the Israelis and Palestinians. Instead, he has aspirations for a nuclear deal with Tehran. The offer is, if they freeze their nuclear development for a decade, then they'll be freed from some of the sanctions that have been crippling their economy. The entire time that deal's being negotiated, the Israeli Prime Minister rages against it.
My friends, for over a year, we've been told that no deal is better than a bad deal. Well, this is a bad deal. It's a very bad deal. We're better off without it.
All the way through the talks, the White House is keeping Netanyahu informed, but his obstructive attitude has them worried. Apparently, the US National Security Agency maintains surveillance on the Israeli Prime Minister, keeping tabs on his conversations with his Republican allies in case he leaks details of the deal to them, Obama's political opponents. In the end, the Iran deal goes ahead. But Netanyahu isn't going to accept it without getting something in return.
He wanted to ensure that there'd be compensation from anything that the United States would do with Iran.
Analyst and former Palestinian negotiator Ahmed Haladi.
So he got from the Obama administration the largest ever security military package, $38 billion over 10 years. This was unprecedented.
Netanyahu's agitation has paid off.
So he used all these cards in a very, I think, intelligent way from his perspective. It was win-win.
It really is a win-win, because although Netanyahu's failed to stop the Iran deal, he just has to wait a while and the next president will scrap it. Donald Trump will change everything. Over his entire career, Netanyahu's had to deal with American presidents he believed just didn't get Israel. Finally, here's one who gives him what he needs. Trump dreams of succeeding with the Israelis and Palestinians where all his predecessors failed and reaching what he calls the deal of the century.
The actual details he left to his team, who were ideologically, sort of biblically committed to the Israeli right, and who designed a plan that, although it spoke of two states, by the way, a plan that was based on almost 98% on Israeli considerations. There was very little consideration for the Palestinian side.
Most observers are not surprised when the Palestinians scoff and refuse to engage on those terms. But as Trump's fantasy is fading away, he takes a momentous step, breaking with all precedent.
Cheers erupted as President Trump's daughter Ivanka and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin opened the new U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, timed to coincide with the 70th anniversary of the founding of the State of Israel.
On behalf of the 45th President of the United States of America, we welcome you officially and for the first time to the Embassy of the United States here in Jerusalem, the capital of Israel. Thank you.
It's an extraordinary day on the Gaza side of the border where I was reporting from. There had been protests in previous weeks, but this felt more passionate. The anger and desperation's palpable, and thousands of demonstrators move towards the high-security border fence. As Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump join Netanyahu in Jerusalem for the new embassy's gala opening, listening to proclamations of peace, in Gaza, 58 Palestinians are killed and thousands more shot and injured by Israeli forces. The embassy move violates the decades-long agreement by the international community of not recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital without a permanent agreement with the Palestinians.
So that came as a shock and a blow to the Palestinians.
Academic and former advisor to the Palestinian leadership, Khaled El-Gindi.
Abbas responded by severing ties with the United States. The U.S. retaliated by cutting off all assistance to the Palestinians and had, I think at that point, already shut down the PLO embassy in Washington. And then we had this kind of standoff between Abbas and Netanyahu.
But this is by no means the last blow inflicted on the Palestinians during the Trump presidency.
Of course, as the years went by, and post-Arab Spring, Arab Awakening, as the region goes through this period of unprecedented polarization, Netanyahu sees an opening in that instability to also deploy the Iran issue as a regional trump card.
Daniel Levy, former Israeli negotiator.
And so Iran also becomes the gateway to some of the alliance building he has successfully done in the region, and he has been able to again deploy that as cover to show that Israel can do whatever it wants to the Palestinians while building a set of close relations in the region.
Netanyahu works hard to get those close relations to the point where they can go public. Announced in 2020 by President Trump standing on a little balcony looking down on the crowd on the White House lawn.
We're here this afternoon to change the course of history. After decades of division and conflict, we mark the dawn of a new Middle East. Thanks to the great courage of the leaders of these three countries, Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, will establish embassies, exchange ambassadors, and begin to cooperate and work together so strongly to cooperate.
The Abraham Accords is a huge diplomatic coup for Netanyahu. The Palestinians are completely sidelined.
The spoken and unspoken Arab consensus was that there would be no normalization with Israel until after, you know, an Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank Gaza Strip and the creation of a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital. And that was the Arab consensus.
Former Palestinian advisor Khaled El-Gindi.
And for that now to be thrown out really undercut the Palestinian issue. And it was designed to do that. That was one of Netanyahu's primary goals, was to prevent a Palestinian state and to marginalize the Palestinian issue. And the Abraham Accords definitely allowed him to do that.
The common bond between the countries is apprehension about Iranian power. But the UAE and Bahrain are the first Arab countries to recognize Israel since Jordan 35 years earlier. Intelligence sharing under the counter has already been happening, but now the relationship is official with great mutual opportunities for trade and travel.
What these agreements did was that it opened up a whole half of the world for Israelis that had never been there before.
Former U.S. diplomat Gerald Feierstein.
For the first time, Ben-Gurion Airport never had a transit lounge because you could never, there was no place to transit. You didn't go anywhere. So, you know, the ability of El Al, for example, or another airline to overfly the Gulf on its way to India or China or elsewhere, you know, changed the whole Israeli mentality. Now they could get on a plane in Tel Aviv and land in New Delhi and, you know, without having to go through Istanbul or Athens or anything else.
And Netanyahu hasn't finished. He starts talking to the rulers of Saudi Arabia, a country that has taken a leadership role among Arab nations. Historically, Saudi was a staunch supporter of the Palestinian cause, but the present regime is different. If the Israeli PM offers some largely cosmetic concessions to the Palestinians, it looks like Prince Mohammed bin Salman might actually be prepared to do a deal recognizing the state of Israel. And if he does, it would really feel like a nail in the coffin of the Palestinian cause. Netanyahu is riding high, says Khaled El-Gindi.
You know, I'm Mr. Security. Everything's under control. Things are looking great. Things have never been better. The economy is booming. Our security's never been better.
Israel has become a global leader in innovation, with a vibrant startup ecosystem, top-ranked universities, and a culture of entrepreneurship and creativity.
Israel's social healthcare policy places its healthcare system as one of the best in the world, while keeping it affordable and accessible.
Here you'll find a true crossroads of the world, where people come to learn, laugh, connect, and immerse themselves in a country with thousands of years of recommendations. No matter which other destinations are on your list, what you see, touch, and feel in Israel, you'll never experience anywhere else.
Israel is booming. Tourists are thronging Tel Aviv's beaches, and as I walk along the seafront, it occurs to me that most are blissfully unaware that a few miles to the south, along the same coast, are the heavily polluted beaches of Gaza under siege. Like some kind of magician, Netanyahu's managed to do what he always dreamed of. He's made the Palestinian issue just kind of disappear. Tel Aviv has everything. There's a huge range of fine dining to rival any Western capital. The club scene is buzzing. The city likes to boast it's one of the world's most gay-friendly places. There are skyscrapers, boutique hotels, bohemian cafes, and vibrant high-tech business districts. And now Israeli tourists can travel to the Gulf for the first time, and vice versa. The Israeli Prime Minister is happy to take all the credit.
Netanyahu thinks that he is the lifesaver of Israel.
His former press spokesman, Aviv Bushinsky.
I don't know any person that read so many books and all the books that Churchill wrote or about Churchill. He always walked with those books. Even in high time of conflict, when my nerves were racking because of things that we had to deal with, Netanyahu always found the time, sit aside, read a few chapters.
He says almost everything Netanyahu does is guided by thoughts of what his legacy might be.
He has a huge sense of history, even an addictive sense of history. And to say that he's careless about it, that he's just that he goes with the flow, he's just there to deal with the challenges, it's not true. He wants to be remembered as someone that really saved Israel.
Brzezinski recalls meeting him at Likud headquarters.
We went to the terrace in Tel Aviv, in the party's office in Tel Aviv, and we went to the terrace and he said, "Ah, you see those buildings?"
The Prime Minister points to the shiny glass skyscrapers rising out of the city, and he says,
"You remember when I was, before I was in power, you didn't see anything like that." And I said to myself, "Is he bullshitting me? Come on." But he really believes that it's only because of him.
This is wholly in character, says Aviv Brzezinski. Netanyahu's former spokesman then tells me a story about one time when his old boss took the credit for something else, too.
There was Garry Kasparov, the famous chess grandmaster, came to Israel and played a simultaneous game. You see in the picture here behind me, it's a simultaneous game. Someone plays chess against many. And he called me if I'm willing to play, and because I like the game. And I went to play against Kasparov. And I luckily I drew. But it was really was lucky. So they wrote in the newspaper that I drew Kasparov. So Netanyahu's secretary called Bibi and said, "Bibi, look, Brzezinski had a draw with Kasparov." So Netanyahu looked at me and he said, "Ah, very nice. You know that I drew Sharansky. Sharansky was also a very, very good chess player. And I remember the event that I whispered the moves from Netanyahu just for the photo. Okay? But he believes that. Okay? So that's Netanyahu. You can say that maybe he convinced himself when someone lies and he believes in his lies, even a lie detector cannot tell. Okay? I don't want to go to that extreme, but in some ways, it is true.
On the back of the Abraham Accords, it seems easy for Netanyahu and many other Israelis to ignore the deepening grievances of Palestinians enjoying none of the civil and political rights of their nearest neighbors.
He gave the people of Israel the idea that you could manage the conflict. There is no need to solve it. There is no problem for Israel.
Liberal lawyer Talia Sasson.
We could make peace agreements with Arab states in the region without the Palestinians. We don't need to solve the Palestinian problem for achieving peace agreement with other countries, Arab countries here in the region. And yes, and people bought it.
Daniel Levy was not one of those people.
Many of us were looking at it and saying, you can make peace with whoever the hell you like, as long as there are millions and millions of disenfranchised Palestinians living under this brutal, illegal regime. This is not going to solve your problem, because your problem isn't with the Emiratis or the Bahrainis. The question of Israel's future will be defined in its relations with the Palestinians. And not only are you ignoring that, but you are accelerating the descent into an unsustainable, unstable situation.
In episode 3 of The State of Netanyahu, a series of events is about to change the country forever, and Netanyahu's reputation and legacy and everything he's fought for is on the line.
It's time for Biden and the others to get into a room with Bibi, if necessary, also with a baseball bat.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Slow Newscast. If you enjoyed it, please do rate us or leave a review. The State of Netanyahu was reported by me, Donald McIntyre, and written by me and Chloe Hadjimatheu, It was produced by Chloe Hajimafeu, sound design by Hannah Varrell. The executive producer of the Slow Newscast is Matt Russell. The editor was Jasper Corbett.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
That's a sort of freedom, like an intrinsic knowledge, like you are part ocean, ocean is part you. You have salt water in your body. You are part of this.
Oceans, life underwater. A new podcast all about the oceans and the mind-blowing life within them.
Subscribe now to Oceans, Life Underwater on your favorite podcast app.